With such a broad title as The Buddha and the Imagination, there are many flights of departure from which to make one's way. In no sense I'm going to try to cover all of them, but I hope to give enough of a background, enough of the principle, for you to embark upon other routes yourself. Indeed, I would contend that how we link or make a connection to the Buddha is of vital importance to every Buddhist or anyone seeking to make some sense of the goal of the Buddhist path, some sense of what Buddhism might actually mean for them. Yet who is the Buddha, and how do we encounter him? Well, the Buddha is many things to us, just listing a few. He's a historical personality. He's a wandering beggar. He's a legendary archetype, almsman, teacher, wise man, the compassionate one, the ascetic, the old 70-year-old man, as we heard earlier on today. The Buddha is many things. Fundamentally, though, the Buddha is a symbol of the goal of Buddhism, of the heights to which the individual human mind can soar. The Buddha is the culmination of human spiritual evolution. The Buddha is what we ourselves can become, what we are in potential. According to the tradition, according to the Buddha himself, each one of us has the ability to grow and to develop, to establish within us qualities not simply reflective of a newer, improved version of our present selves, but something radically different. A being that, according to Gotama himself, is not to be classed as human or divine, but enlightened. The Buddha is beyond the reach of logic, beyond the reach of thought. The Buddha is not a concept. Therefore, we must find ways to encounter him that can take us beyond these limits. Once enlightened, we may look, barring the imposition of age and illness, as we do now. But the qualities we would exemplify are transcendental in nature, breaking out of the limits of the known into a landscape of ceaseless horizons. It is us that make the journey beyond the known. And according to Sangharakshita, it is the faculty of the imagination that provides the means to do so. Yet perhaps I'm jumping ahead a little. Let's start with us. Us here. All of us are perceiving at this moment. I can see you. I can even smell some of you. I can hear some of you. In other words, we're in contact. There's an encounter. For ordinary everyday purposes, we can say that when there's contact, three elements are present. On one side of the pole, there's something indefinably us. On the other side, there's something else. And of course, it can be difficult sometimes to establish clearly where each of those begin and which of those and where each of them ends. But there's also a medium through which the encounter takes place, through which the contact happens. This contact conditions a feeling of pleasure, a feeling of pain, or neutral feeling. We then respond to that, habitually speaking, with craving or aversion. A more subtle inner sense pervades this whole experience, though, particularly if one is consciously seeking to grow and develop. This subtle sense, or faculty, is what Sangharakshita has labelled the imagination. It is through this faculty that we can begin to respond creatively rather than habitually, and through which we can encounter the Buddha. It is with the development of this faculty that the Buddha can appear to us more and more clearly, to the extent that we ourselves have begun to become him. But what is this imaginal faculty, and what world does it open up? Let's begin by looking at what the imagination is not. It is not fantasy, nor fancy. In the definition that Sangharakshita uses, he draws on the romantic poet, scholar, Samuel Taylor Coleridge. Fancy, according to Coleridge, reorganizes aspects of our known world in a different way, in the pursuit of pleasure or survival. What might this mean? Well, we fall out of love with one person to fall in love with another person. We crave one thing at one time, we move to another aspect of desire at another. We turn the heating on when it's cold, we turn it off when it's not, when it's warm. We eat when hungry, we don't eat when full. With fancy, there's no deeper moral or spiritual significance to how we relate to things. With imagination, something else can happen. It brings unity to the forms we perceive, and we find within it deeper significance and underlying connection. In other words, imagination is the faculty that allows us to relate to things, to the world, from the perspective of an individual that is seeking to make conscious progress towards spiritual awakening. And first of all, perhaps, a happy, healthy human being. Imagination is therefore intrinsic to the individual mind, to our hearts, to our life. We therefore have the opportunity to cultivate it, develop it, rather than actually discovering something completely new, something foreign. This process of development, though, is not limited. If the function of the imagination is to connect things on a deeper level, this includes what we conceive of as ourselves. Ultimately, it is not that we have a faculty of imagination, but that in a sense, we are imagination. Related to this is that imagination has within it sense of knowing, of understanding. Most of this I've drawn from Subhuti's and Sangharakshita's recent paper on the imagination. And actually, I couldn't help, the more I look into it, I couldn't help wondering what the relationship was between imagination and awareness. And awareness certainly has this cognitive dimension, this sense of knowing and understanding. So, imagination is not unknown to us, even if it can be developed more fully. It recognizes something in us that is more than our individual selves. In other words, we must let go somewhat of trying to work it all out, or too readily trying to make sense of something and fix it to the known. We must be prepared to see oneself more as a witness to things in this new landscape, and in terms of spiritual qualities, a vehicle for things, a medium, rather than seeing ourselves as the messenger, the author of it all. One can see this a bit in meditation. So the more absorbed we become in an object of meditation, like the breath, the more the imagination comes into its own. And the more we have to make a different kind of effort, very subtle, in which one of our functions is simply to keep at bay the tendency to try to make a sense of or interpret the experiences we're having. In some senses, our main job is just to get out of the way. If we do this, though, our absorption can become clouded and we lose momentum. A third aspect of the imagination is that it transforms the objects of our experience. Well, it transforms really how we relate to them. Things become not the bringers of pain or pleasure to which we react by rejecting or grasping, but references, symbols that connect us with deeper meaning, transcendental qualities such as compassion, and our heart's ultimate longings. The imagination also unifies us, bringing together all the objects of our experience and holding them without conflict. we have sometimes, it seems, many different sides. And it's through the imagination that those sides can start to enter into harmonious habitation, you might say. Live together. Finally, imagination is dynamic and ascending. Imagination is the intermediary between us and our highest aspirations. Ultimately, therefore, the Buddha. As we explore our world with this tool, the more sensitive it becomes, and the closer, therefore, do we raise consciousness to ever newer heights of satisfaction and meaning. So if the Buddha is to be sensed with the imagination, then he must be sensed by us, as we are now. We are alive, so our imaginations must grow. This must happen in the context of our lives now. The imagination can do this by our conscious choice, but very often these choices occur against the tide of a seemingly overwhelming habit. Even instinct to perceive things and react to them in the same old way. All too often, it seems, we are not guided by the imagination, but by more limited sense. Fancy, perhaps. The basic plan here with fancy is to remove pain and increase or hang on to pleasure. Yet this strategy causes us to struggle in all sorts of ways. Because even if we change the particular objects of our experience, we can't change the common features of the things themselves. Their impermanence, their unsatisfactoriness, their insubstantiality. This is so difficult to overcome, and we are often the fools of our fancies, prisoners to predilection and slaves to sense pleasure. Well, if you're like me, that is. All of this can sound rather dispiriting, but the reason I mention it is much more the opposite. To be riddled with mistakes is to be a human being, and the first field in which imagination must roam is in this arena. We must bring imagination down to us, just as we must be opened up to its potential heights. As I stand here in front of you, as we experience each other, all these aspects of our basic humanity are somehow present too. If Buddhahood exists as potential within us, so does its opposite, confusion and bewilderment, craving, ill will, anxiety, pride, grief, sadness and doubt. If we are to grow, we must see these in ourselves. We must, as it were, bring light to them. We must imagine them. In their discussion on the imagination, Subhuti and Sangharaksha talk of three different aspects or shapes that imagination can take. That's not the right word necessarily. But the main thing I want to say is that there's one particularly that I'm going to concentrate on or give some time to. And that's when they talk about imagination as an empathy with all life. The Buddha, it seems, had interactions with beings of many different kinds, not just human ones. There were those that inhabited jungles, jungle shrines, places that invoked fear and dread. Some that were naughty and mischievous, some that were benign or even friendly. The Buddha also seemed to encounter various gods and goddesses, of many different kinds and at many different levels. He also, of course, encountered the earth goddess and Mara, the latter complete with warrior sons and temptress daughters, on the eve of his enlightenment. Then there was his relationship with animals. Interestingly, the blurb for the retreat Sarahar is leading in June on the Buddha refers to him as the bull among heroes. A lion roaring the lion's roar, the king's mighty war elephant. These animals, animal comparisons, have their meaning in the proximity of them to human life at the time. The weight of meaning in the comparison would be substantial all those years ago. more so than it is today. It does seem as if we have largely lost contact with our nature spirits and the richly animated world that the Buddha existed in. Yet although the forms may have been lost, we can make contact and encourage an awareness of life around us, to sense it, to feel it, to imagine it. Sangharakshita's perspective is that this capacity is necessary for us to develop, because it's from here that our ethical life moves from a self-restraint, i.e. not doing things, avoiding doing things, to the precepts becoming much more an affirmation, a positive affirmation of our deep-seated connection with all life, and our realization of our place in a living universe. Ethics or morality in this context is imagining solidarity with all life. Perhaps this existed within us in childhood, in an undeveloped but immediate form. Through imagination, we can give it, well, not only shape, we can not only nurture it, but we can give it an environment in which to breathe, in which to grow. Again, it is not that this capacity is foreign to us, rather that we can recognise what is there. Life, according to Sangharakshita, is undeniable. We sense it. We are alive. And we sense other life when we encounter it. Beneath the surface of our ordinary attentiveness, there's a hum, even a vibration, that we are not often very aware of. And yet we resonate with this vibration. Perhaps we notice it sometimes when we pick up on the opposite. When something doesn't seem right, as when you're in the company of people and they are considering actions, and they are considering doing actions that you consider harsh or cruel. You can sense something beyond or beneath the words that seems to reject something deeply within you. Even something within themselves that I would suggest is this empathy for life. This can lead us, of course, to protect and nurture the living environment around us, from plants to animals to human beings. Sangharakshita thinks that rediscovering this natural sensitivity is the key to a genuine, heartfelt and deeply sensitive ethical response to other human beings. He's fond of quoting the romantic poet Shelley in discussions on metta, who speaks of a secret to ethics as residing in this identification with another, with the beautiful in another. Not simply this, but with their pleasures and pains also. Metta is therefore an active dimension of this resonance of life with and for life. Having the capacity to reach its fullness in relationship with those of our own species, i.e. other human beings, we will seek out those who share this moral sensitivity, those who wish to sense more deeply this vibration, so that friendship and fellowship based in an affirmation of life can be imagined between us. A further stage of this empathy is the natural and spontaneous outpouring of compassion for beings in difficulties. This need not just be for difficulties of an obvious kind, but even for spiritual misunderstandings. When we are sensitive to others, we are sensitive to the world that they make for themselves. Worlds, it can be seen, that bring difficulties. To its highest degree, this compassion is what the Buddha feels for the unenlightened. He loves them deeply, seeing them in the midst of their ups and downs, insecure against the winds of their world. He witnesses with a tender and truthful heart people relating to things from hope rather than a genuine confidence in what they are. Again, this experience is not something totally foreign to us, and acknowledging these smaller manifestations will lead one to meet with others similarly persuaded, helping it to grow. Traditionally, of course, this means the formation or becoming part of a sangha. It also means, of course, in our modern world, Buddhist centres. I've spoken of the Buddha as the awakened, enlightened, or even illuminated mind. For Buddhists, the Buddha is a symbol for the highest, deepest, and most far-reaching transformation that occurs on the level of our individual human experience. For Buddhists, this ideal is not a point as such, but a way. I've introduced also the imaginal faculty, which is the medium through which we can encounter the Buddha, in which we can draw ourselves to him and simultaneously be drawn and transformed by him. I've then spoken of the imagination in a different way, of how it must descend into our difficulties in order for us to see them for what they are, in order that we get to meet not just the Buddha, but our greed, our hate, our self-preoccupation, our fears, our sorrows, our doubt, and so on. I would even contend that this is, in a sense, how we get to meet the Buddha. Sangharakshita's ideas on the imagination are concerned to help us see the Buddha in new forms appropriate to our contemporary world, to our history, to our cultural backgrounds. He views this as the essential task of Tree Ratna Buddhism. We are not simply to see in forms of Eastern origin, forms in a sense foreign to us. Although this can sound rather radical, and in a sense it is radical, it is no different from what the early Buddhists did after the time of the Buddha. The classic image of the Buddha, seated in meditation, took some time to develop. Not only is there historical precedent, therefore, we have the famous teaching the Buddha gives to Subhuti in the Diamond Sutra. This isn't a direct translation, but close enough. Those who by my form do see me do not see the Buddha. Those that see the Dharma see the Buddha. It is by plunging into the Dharma, by realizing the Dharma, that the Buddha will emerge. He may not look quite like what we think. This does not mean, though, that we have no connection with the Buddha before awakening. We do. We have his life, found in the Pali scriptures, that not only help to clarify his teachings, but give us an insight into how he lived, both before and after his enlightenment. I'm going to look a little at the former. I think this is interesting because it gives us a sense of how the Buddha imagined himself free from difficulties that we would recognize as difficulties for ourselves. It gives us a sense, therefore, of the function of the imagination, not only as empathy for life, but as illumined with or by the Dharma. The particular sutta is known as the Bhayabharava Sutta, translated as a teaching on fear and dread. Fear, anxiety, is something we all encounter. It's something we all have in common. For some of us, it will seem to us a most, if not the most, painful aspect of life. It may be the reason for us coming through the doors of a Buddhist centre in the first place. In the sutta, the Buddha is staying in Sarvati, in Jetta's grove of Anathapindika's park. He is approached by a Brahmin, Janusoni. Now, Janusoni has something on his mind, and one senses from his question that fear and anxiety are involved. He asks the Buddha if people that have left home through faith in the Buddha, those that have embarked on the spiritual life, see him as their leader, their helper, and their guide. The Buddha says yes. If they have gone forth through faith in him, then yes, they see him as their leader, their helper, and their guide. Now we start to get to the heart of what concerns Janusoni. He says to the Buddha, "But jungle thickets are hard to endure. Seclusion is hard to practice. And it is hard to enjoy solitude. One would think that the jungles would rob someone of their mind if they have no concentration." "Yes," says the Buddha, "that is so. They are hard to endure. Seclusion is hard to practice. It is hard to enjoy solitude," and so on. Then the Buddha says something quite interesting. He says that before his illumination, before enlightenment, he thought just as Janusoni did. In other words, these places evoke for the Buddha anxiety, fear, and dread. Then the Buddha goes on to say that he chose to reflect on why he might experience this fear and dread. And he began to realize that due to a number of conditions, he needn't necessarily experience it. He imagined himself as experiencing something different. The young man, Gotama, recognized that he would not enter the jungle with a mind filled with hate, seeking to push something away. He would not enter the forests with a mind because he couldn't be bothered engaging with his life. He would not enter the jungle thickets restless, uncertain of his intention, blown about by the worldly winds of praise and blame. He would not enter the jungle wanting fame and honour. He would not enter with laziness, and he would not enter unmindfully. Quite the opposite. The young man Gotama was beginning to become confident. He was confident that his mind was actually one of energy, mindfulness. He was peaceful, with few wishes, and filled with loving kindness. One could say, in other words, I'm going to say, that Gotama had developed an empathy with life for life, in which his imagination had developed to a recognition of the fact of his own aliveness, enabling a natural moral connection and vibration with other living things, a stilling of the mind, and a purity of intention. Jungle thickets might seem hard to endure, but Gotama was prepared. It was time to open up, to go forward, to allow his imagination to expand into the next level of his world. I say next level, but again the jungle is thick, dense, it is dark. Pathways are hard to come by, even if they exist at all. Not only that, but jungles teem with life, some of it objectively dangerous to him. He would have known this. He would have felt that threat. The way that I've tended to experience fear is that there's a sense of a threat that comes from outside. Usually, I'd say it's more anxiety than fear. Usually, the threat was more internal than external, as it were. It's as if I'd created an object in my mental landscape, quite often in connection with a previous experience, but sometimes perhaps just a scenario that I've invented. And I don't like it. In reaction, these would tend to get pushed away, buried. But this actually only seemed to give them a place, a hidden place, that was out of reach from me, where no light goes, and yet from which I was still affected by them. Gotama enters the jungle because he's ready. He now wishes to shine a light on such things, to see what happens when he dwells in places that are generally thought of as provoking fear and dread, difficulty and pain. Let's go with it. So, he goes to some of the ancient shrines deep in the jungle, goes on auspicious nights, such as those of the full new and half moon. Nights, that is, when generally people might expect to encounter fear and dread. Gotama describes these shrines as awe-inspiring, even horrifying. And he would, when there, hear noises. The wind rustling the leaves in the trees. A peacock snapping the branch of a tree somewhere close by. Or, even worse, a wild animal approaching. Yet Gotama is ready for change. He's ready to open his imagination up to what is actually happening. He questions why he expects to experience fear and anxiety. He says, why do I dwell always expecting fear and dread? Why not just let it happen if it's going to happen? And let go of the expectation of it happening. So, he does. And he does so deciding that when it arises, he won't change whatever posture he's in. He'll stay with the fear and dread and he'll see what happens. I don't know about you, but I can find this pretty challenging. Yeah? It can be all too easy to allow oneself to be distracted away from anxiety, particularly if that anxiety is subtle, slightly beneath the surface, like a little nag or an itch. But Gotama is not giving himself the option. He's put himself in this most difficult of situations in which people expect to encounter threats to life, in which people expect to encounter fear and dread. In other words, you could say that he commits to it. He commits to his experience. He commits to life. Because he believes that if he does so, he'll become free of how he thinks life is. He commits to a developing moral sense, an empathy for life as his experience. And in doing so, his imagination is opening up, opening him up to a different way, to an understanding of how things actually are. He's alive, and he wants to feel that in order to understand what it means at its deepest and most meaningful. His intention to do so was not simply enough. Fear and dread came repeatedly. Yet his commitment was so resolute that it wasn't to be moved. If it happened when standing, he continued standing. If it happened when walking, he continued walking. If it happened when seated, he continued sitting. And if it happened when lying down, he continued lying down. At no point did he change his posture until any fear and dread that arose was subdued until it had ceased to be. Then the Buddha, in the sutta, says something interesting and rather ordinary in a way, or I read it as ordinary. He says that there are some wanderers and some priests who perceive day when it is night and night when it is day. The Buddha says that they are therefore abiding in delusion. But, he says, I perceive night when it is night, and day when it is day. Following this, he says, were it to be said of anyone, a being not subject to delusion has appeared in the world for the welfare and happiness of many, out of compassion for the world, for the good, welfare and happiness of gods and humans. It is of me that, rightly speaking, this should be said. Gotama is therefore now a Buddha, the Buddha. An empathy for life has opened up to its fullness, including its jungle-hidden fear and dread. His imagination has explored and filled this landscape, and it has now done so illuminated by the Dharma. Gotama has encountered the Buddha, and he has done so by seeing the Dharma, by seeing night when it is night and day when it is day. Gotama has seen the Buddha realized as himself. What then happens? Well, the Buddha makes time to enjoy his newfound freedom. He just sits back and relishes in it. Then he reflects upon how our actions condition our experience. He sees the law of karma at work for all beings. Subsequent to that, he brings his awareness to an understanding of the Four Noble Truths, of how beings suffer. What causes this? And now, of course, he knew, directly for himself, the fact of freedom from it and the way that leads to this freedom. When we seek to connect with the Buddha, imagination is the medium for doing so. This involves cultivating imagination as an empathy for life, feeling ourselves to be alive, and recognizing the under-the-surface resonance we have with all other life forms. This involves bringing imagination to our life, including its difficulties, allowing it to descend, as it were, into our hopes and fears, our pleasures and our pains. When we can see and understand the Dharma of these, when our imaginations are illumined, then we can cease seeking him and recognize we found him, not separate from ourselves. This is to truly imagine the Buddha. Like a Gotama, we must commit to this path in order to arrive at this point, as it were, that I mentioned earlier, of ceaseless horizons, the Buddha mind. If we sit on the fence of vacillation, then the companions of hope and doubt will forever sit beside us. And we risk becoming merely the fools of our fantasies, grasping after something that is forever out of reach. Yet if we have the courage to enter the fray, to enter the jungle, to become sensitive to our life as part of life, we can get to know our individual and collective fragility and the mess of our instincts and habits to ignore, to hate, and to grasp. If we can feel these with the intention of understanding them, then we can rediscover not only the richly embroidered tapestries of the imagination, but that imagination illumined by self's transcendence, the going beyond, always going beyond, of the Buddha. For most of us, the jungles and forests of sub-Himalayan India are not places we dwell in on a regular basis. Our jungle is of an urban kind. Life can seem held at bay in the mass of concrete, steel and brickwork. Our jungle shrines are not concerned with nature spirits. They are the person next to us on the number 50 bus. Drunk football fans on the way home after a victory. A boss's critical appraisal. That argumentative client. Here we will feel our difficulties. Here we will pay respects to our expectations by fulfilling them with our anger and frustration, our craving and grasping, and our ignorance. It is therefore here that our imaginations must come alive, must ignite, that we can see clearly the fruits of our habits, and in the light of that clarity, illumine our imaginations so that they become vehicles for freedom. When they do, we can then help other beings meet what they most clearly long for. This illumination must not be confined to the mind, but it must take practical, down-to-earth shape. First and foremost, in our interpersonal relationships. But not just there. It must manifest in the buildings we occupy, the cities, towns, streets and homes we live in, and the Buddhist centres we attend. Two years ago, the trustees of the Buddhist centre here opened their imaginations to envision a transformed Buddhist centre, a centre that offered better facilities for those that attended, and new facilities for those that find it difficult to attend at present. The centre of this vision is a space filled with light, a centre illumined by the sun, just as our imaginations become illumined by the Dharma. Such a vision, of course, is fulfilled by collective effort. It also costs money. Our fundraising target was a bold one, £40,000 in a year. The end of that year is the end of July 2011. My proposed departure. So far, we've raised an impressive £10,000. We've received two relatively large individual donations, but aside from this money, the money has come from numerous acts of generosity. Teams of people working together in order to fulfil not a fundraising target, really. Not only a new centre, but an opportunity for their imaginations to grow, to become part of our vision for Sangha, for cooperation, generosity, and the mutual support that are hallmarks of spiritual community. Wouldn't it be great if we could reach our target? There are some events coming up, starting with a concert next weekend on Saturday. And I hope you'll be inspired to attend these. Together, I'm confident that more money can be raised. Together, I think we can make this urban jungle a place of beauty, of inspiration, accessibility, and of course, a context for transcendental illumination.